at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Relations are heating up between the Salisbury City Council and the mayor, and we'll also take a look at how people cope in the aftermath of events like the recent theater shooting in Colorado. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. We first turn our attention to the events unfolding down at City Hall in Salisbury. They took a turn when the mayor, Jim Ironton, offered up a proposal to help revitalize the downtown area. It was reportedly rejected by the council, and that led to a sharp set of exchanges between the mayor and the members of the council majority. Take a look at what's going on with these events and the future of Salisbury. Our in-studio guest is Council President Terry Cohen, and welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Don.
Well, let's start with the mayor's proposal. I guess that's where at least the recent exchange has taken place. My understanding is he offered up to wanted to provide, say, 193 equivalent dwelling units, and we'll get into what that means, from Lenna's the Week property for downtown, talking about selling off parking lots and so on. What was, from your perspective, how was this proposal presented, and what characterized your own reaction to, and the council majority reaction to it?
Sure. The council was not included as a body in the development of this plan, and we kept hearing about this plan and all the things that were going into creating this plan, but not included except to say, you know, buy a ticket to a chamber luncheon, you can hear the mayor speak about it. When it actually did get presented to us, that was June 4th. Instead of a briefing on the plan, we got a 270-page book on CD June 4th, and 4 days before the meeting. And we came to the meeting, and instead of a briefing, an informative briefing, we had a media event. The cameras that were there, the microphones were there, and, you know, the folks were there. So it wasn't terribly informative beyond what we already knew. So we said, well, okay, you've had your presentation, so now we'll, you know, take a look at the materials you provided, and we'll bring this back for discussion. I don't know. Have you read the 270-page plan?
I have not.
Okay. Well, I have it with me. I know that won't translate well on radio, but we have a blank page for table of contents, and then we have another page showing the table of contents next. And it's mostly about the parking lots and EDUs, but it includes a number of things. There's about two or three pages of prose in there that explain what the so-called plan is, which is really to surplus all the parking lots and put them out for bid and see what's out there, which is a concept that Mr. Comegys came up with a couple of years ago, and the council then didn't want to move forward with it. So the mayor advanced something that he already knew had some opposition, or at least not a lot of interest. Then when you look at the plan, the 270 pages are mostly old deeds, some current maps, a lot of public works diagrams of water mains and sewer laterals. I would say that's the bulk of the plan. And then there are things in there that have already been done. For example, the mayor said that we're the Council of No, or the majority of the members are Council of No, and yet he's included things in this paperwork that the council's already approved or has been supportive of. So I think it's quite the political maneuver to be using that kind of rhetoric when the facts don't bear it out.
Well, let me say, I want to get something straight here. So he presented this, and one of the questions I had was its disposition, because I got the impression that basically said you weren't going to take this plan up. Is that how you viewed what the council action was?
I think In terms of what he is proposing here, the two main components of what he is proposing are the EDUs and the surplusing of the parking lots. I don't think the majority of the council finds that a good approach to revitalizing downtown. And if you can show me successful downtowns across the country that have used that approach as a way of rebuilding, I'd be happy to entertain it, but no such information was forthcoming from the mayor. Even when we did discuss it on July 3rd, or July 4th, no, it would have been July 2nd, I guess, somewhere around there. When we did discuss it, the information that was forthcoming from staff wasn't terribly informative, and one of the questions that we had asked was about market studies and what they knew about the what the downtown would be drawing in terms of market, and those questions either couldn't be answered or weren't answered satisfactorily.
By the way, I want to ask, let's go back to this equivalent dwelling unit. For our listeners, explain what that means, because we've been throwing that term around, and why do you think that may not be such a good idea? Because my understanding, at least from talking to the mayor and what I've read, is that these units would come from the Linens of the Week property, which I understand used to be industrial at one point. Doesn't look as if it's going in that direction, is what I understand. And that's, in any event, he was proposing utilize those as a way, as an incentive, I guess, to businesses. So explain what an EDU is and what you find problematic.
First of all, we have not decided what the disposition of that building is. It was given supposedly as a gift to the city, but it was an environmentally contaminated property. And one of the things that Mayor Ireton has conveniently left out of that discussion in terms of our taking it was the amount of information I provided to him about working with the MDE and EPA, which he had not done at the time that he had already decided that he wanted to take that property for the city. So I think that that helped in the outcome, but we have not decided the disposition of that. So, you know, he's saying, well, withhold some for, you know, any possible appropriate use. And then he spent 8 minutes in a tirade in his last interview with you on July 6th, essentially personally, in very derogatory terms, attacking members of council. When we look at, for example, he referred to Council Vice President Campbell as a flip-flopper because she approved a comprehensive plan and has concerns about what would go in that Linens of the Week spot. It's not uncommon to vote for an overall comprehensive plan but not agree with necessarily every single point in it. The EDUs are a measurement of water and sewer usage, and it represents equivalent dwelling units, and that simply explains how many gallons usage, and then it's used as a standard measurement for whatever the use might be. A single-family home is certainly going to use less than an office building, for example.
Now, this I guess one of the quotes that certainly has gotten a lot of attention, and I believe it's attributed to you, the quote goes, they should continue working, I assume that's you, should continue to working on plans that have been put on the back burner for a while and that would require few subsidies. Is subsidies an issue here in terms of the mayor's approach?
I think it potentially is. He mentioned the pending list that has, from my suggestion, looking at what we want downtown to be and what incentives we might want to provide to local or targeted businesses. I'm on the public record as to what that meant, and it certainly didn't mean what this proposal is. I've never been against subsidies. I just feel that they should be used in a very targeted way and very wisely and sparingly, because otherwise you end up with a Chicago and Illinois situation where every other block's got a tax increment financing deal, and it's not beneficial for the long-term health of the community that it's serving.
Let me just ask you a vision question. So what is your vision? If you look at downtown, what is it that you see in that area for the future? I mean, if you had what you would like out of that area, what would it be? Because a lot of people would want to ask, where are we going? You know, what is it supposed to look like? I've talked to some people who obviously are going to be running for mayor, and they have their own different visions about it. What's yours?
Well, interestingly, you should ask that, because I don't think that this should be about my vision or Jim's vision or anyone else, one individual's vision. I found it very striking that in your last interview with the mayor that he said, sign the petition, help me out, not help the community or, you know, help Salisbury move forward. It was help me out. And he made a lot of references to political things going on. And I think that's part of what has bogged down a productive discussion about downtown.
Well, and the reason why I ask is that obviously everybody has their own particular idea about what's downtown. And so when I ask the question, it's not necessarily that your vision is going to be the one that ultimately plays out, but I'm trying to get a sense, particularly from city leaders, what is it that they think will be in downtown to revitalize it? I mean, what kind of that? And that's what I'm asking. I realize it may not be the one that's chosen,
sure.
Or you may change your mind down the road. I understand that too. But what is it? I mean, that's
well. I think, and Don, this is really important. I understand what you're asking here. Is people want their leaders to be visionaries, and I think part of being visionary is asking what do the people who live in this community want to see it become.
Do you have a sense about that?
Well, I think a lot of people would like to see it as a gathering place and an activities place. This is one of the things that a lot of successful downtowns have, and they have certain things in common, although they don't necessarily go about obtaining them in the same way because of the differences. For example, Salisbury has this island effect with its downtown that needs to be approached. But a young lady who had signed the petition, she said it really wasn't that. She said she hadn't read the plan. She said, I was just signing it because I'd like somebody to pay attention to downtown, which is understandable. And we have done that. One of the things in the mayor's proposal is the urban Salisbury plan that was drafted by architect Max Verbitz, which Mrs. Campbell and I went to those meetings, and we talked up that, and we were supportive of it. When it was first brought out by Urban Salisbury, after they closed their doors, we still supported it, and we voted to approve the CIP that includes the work to be done on those plans. So how, again, can the mayor say that we're the council of no? This is, I think, you know, getting a petition drive going with a line like, it's high time that they stop saying no to anything and everything positive that we try to accomplish. When I talk about things that are on the back burner, he likes to make a big example out of the trash comment.
Right, that's one of those comments, yes.
You know, my intent there was just to throw out one example without taking up a long time at the meeting with a long list. But it was also to say, you know, if you're not going to resolve these seemingly simple issues, how are you going to undertake this grandiose plan involving all these parking lots that affects, you know, the entire complexion of downtown? You know, let's get the things done that we've all agreed, we've said yes to, done that we said, and incrementally, that's part of what helps grow downtown. I can tell you among certain communities within the city that there are some competing visions for what downtown will be. And I think it's really important that we have an open and honest discussion among those varying interests before we decide what it is that we want downtown to be. And I think that's a big part of deciding what direction and what approach we're going to have.
I also want to turn to the media issue because I think it was the Salisbury Daily Times talked about the terms of downtown, and I believe I have the quote here. There's a fly in the ointment. The city council has become a committee of no. No, we won't approve any plans. No, we won't embrace anyone's vision. No, we have no vision of our own to offer. And at one point it goes on and says, using lame excuses about trash pickup and wanting to continue working on plans that have been sitting on the back burner. What's going on here? Because I've read something, and there was a resolution, I guess, to try to correct a record in what you view as being not good information out there. What's going on in terms of the coverage here? And I saw that you said that you don't want to be holding press conferences. I think it was a deal to respond to issues. What's happening here?
Well, the mayor made it pretty clear some time ago that he was going to be waging war. He did it as being the first mayor in at least 40 years, if not longer or ever, to veto a budget over relatively modest items. This year, he threatened to do it again, even though the council had said that they would support virtually every spending request that he had, simply because we found money to stave off a tax increase. So, yeah, we said no to a tax increase, but we said yes to pretty much everything he needed and wanted for the operation of the city. What you just read to me is the same distorted rhetoric that the mayor has been saying. It almost sounds word for word for what he has been saying. So, you know, is the newspaper so closely aligned in its viewpoints with the mayor, or, you know, the mayor back in November had a secret meeting by invitation only at the chamber with some very select former officials, current officials, business people, and the newspaper sent me, you know, partial transcript of it, asking me questions about it. You know, I was elected to work, and I read an interesting article about workhorses versus show horses that I thought was pretty interesting and perhaps applicable to this situation. But, I mean, we're the ones who have said yes to cleaning up the river. We've said yes to the urban Salisbury plans that are now in the CIP that we said yes to. We said yes to the Mojos. One of the things in his listing there is the Mojos and the revolving fund. Well, we said yes to that. In fact, we've gone one step further that the mayor has not responded to, which is let's revisit the revolving fund and see if maybe we need to broaden the amount of money that it's able to work with. Before, we were concerned about money going into one large project. Now we may want to have that option because that one large project may be the thing that creates an anchor for downtown, or at least a portion of it. We've said yes to the farmers market. We said yes to the arts and crafts market on the River Place. We've said yes to the Third Friday volunteers who were paying for a lot of their work out of their own pocket. The list goes on. Yes to trying to keep the library downtown. Yes to Evo Brewery and their needs in terms of getting additional license and opening up the well for their brewing operation. Yes to the Creek Watchers. We even gave them more money for testing the river. So what you just read to me is not borne out by the public record.
One final question. We only have about a minute or so left to go. Because one of the things that actually popped out at me, because I've been covering government leaders for a long time, both locally and nationally. And one of the things that popped out of me was, there was a quote that says, "I was not elected to spend my time doing press conferences to explain my every word," quote unquote. And one of the things that struck me about is that irrespective of one thinks about one media outlet as opposed to another, one of the things I found over the years is that actually it is incumbent upon political leaders and governmental leaders to communicate their message. And oftentimes that is done through press conferences and that kind of thing in order to get one's media. And it is part of the job. Okay,
So when I look at
political leaders and I watch a lot of them, that's what they do. If there's somebody, for instance, who holds a news conference that attacks whatever position that they have, they will come out and they will certainly make that present. Anyway, so that was just
let me put that in perspective.
Go ahead.
I think what I really meant there was that I was not elected to spend all my time responding to distortions and political rhetoric and nationally divisive attacks. I cannot believe that in our lovely city, which is nonpartisan, that the mayor has brought the national vitriol of partisan politics to the discussion at the level that he has. I mean, now he is trying to make this case that I'm some sort of a blind follower of a citizen who has a blog, and now all of a sudden I'm a right-winger. That is the most preposterous and ridiculous thing I've ever heard, and I've listened to him attack people who have different political viewpoints when really they just have concerns. And, you know, I wasn't elected as a Democrat. I wasn't elected to represent only people of my own party. I'm here to listen to everyone. So I think really that was the intent of my comment, was that if the mayor takes up all our time by throwing bombs, political rhetoric bombs out there, and throwing fits and using the public podium at our meetings for grandstanding, and I have to spend all my time working on that instead of the work of the city, our business will not get done, just as he said, you know, there would be a problem with that. We've had 137 meetings in 15 months, Don. 15 of those were special meetings. We've been working on the wastewater treatment plant negotiations. We have been working on long-term issues such as election redistricting from the 2010 census, something that's only done every 10 years. We're doing the same thing with the Enterprise Zone. There are only so many hours in a day, and if the mayor takes it up with things that, frankly, I don't think are priorities and uses it to put out distortions and personal attacks and trying to skew things on a national political level when we're trying to talk about local issues here and the quality of life of our residents, I'm going to opt to do the work.
We've been speaking with Council President Terry Cohen, President of the Salisbury City Council, and we'll be back in a moment. Just a week ago, an armed man entered a theater in Aurora, Colorado, and shot 12 people to death, wounding dozens of others. His name is James Holmes, a once promising student. Welcome back to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. We want to now explore the ramifications of that event with Michael Finnegan. He's the executive director of the Peninsula Mental Health Services in Salisbury. His organization provides assistance to government and law enforcement organizations in Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Well, Michael, first of all, I wanted to ask you, as like a lot of people, what was your reaction when you first began to hear this story unfold? I guess because it actually began to unfold overnight because it was a midnight showing, and then we kind of like began to find out more and more as the day went on. What was your own reaction, first of all?
My own reaction was that sickening feeling in my stomach, a normal reaction to anxiety, really focusing in on the victims, of what those families, those mothers, those fathers, those husbands and wives who had lost loved ones or had them severely injured were going through.
Now, one of the interesting things is that there are a lot of folks who survived who were not necessarily injured. Matter of fact, some of them escaped. There was Amanda Gonzalez, for instance, who talks about suffering recurring headaches and an upset stomach. Says, I keep on having flashbacks of what I saw when I was leaving the theater. I went to work on Saturday but couldn't focus. I keep hearing the gunshots and seeing the people covered in blood. And at one point she says that day was the longest in her life and felt like sometimes like she wanted to scream at the customers. Is that a normal reaction if you've been in that kind of situation?
Yes, it's a very normal reaction occurring at a very high frequency. For example, in law enforcement, where an officer is involved in a line of duty shooting, 44% of officers in the United States will experience flashbacks, as the woman that you just mentioned, seeing the blood, that's an example of a flashback. But that's a very normal reaction. And with assisting individuals with critical, what we refer to as critical incidents, and these can be massive disasters, as we saw in Katrina, or these acts of violence that we have just seen in Aurora, Colorado, that individuals will experience cognitive symptoms such as concentration, distractibility, hypervigilance. They'll experience physical symptoms like the butterflies in the stomach or rapid heartbeat or a dry mouth. That they'll experience emotional symptoms of fear and excessive worry. You can also have spiritual symptoms such as questioning, where is God in all of this, or a loss of that sense of security of their worldview. But that these are normal symptoms, normal reactions to a life-threatening situation.
Now, the other thing that I found interesting was it was a 28-year-old, I guess, student from University of Denver, and his name is Austin, and he talked about how he couldn't sleep, but one of the things that really struck me is he said, why do I feel so much shame? He apparently wrote this. He said, I didn't help anyone or even look back. I jumped over a person. That's hardly heroic. I feel very small right now. That's sort of another category of people. What about, is that also a normal thing? And how does one deal with that?
Well, it's called survivor guilt. And it is associated with a sense that we could have done something different to change the outcome of the situation or done something different to protect another life. The problem that occurs and how this reaction, this survival guilt occurs, is that we judge our behavior based on the knowledge that we have now, as opposed to the knowledge of the situation that we had at the time of the incident. And all of us will come up short when we judge our behavior in the past based on the knowledge that we have today. Also, it is a way in which individuals try and regain a sense of control that, well, if I would have done this and this and this, I would have reduced that suffering. A lot of the time, There's nothing that we can do. And how you deal with that is by asking these questions. Socrates taught by asking questions. And the doctors that work for me, as we are responding to police officers across the state, is that we ask questions to get those police officers to come up with answers, accurate answers, that get them to realize that, in fact, they had no control over the situation. The perpetrator was firing a weapon, pointing a gun, and they had to respond. And even though that resulted in the taking of a life, that they really had no choice.
Now, one of the things that I was reading is that the kind of impact that this can have can be, and we, you know, there's sort of this acute, I guess they call it, a sort of acute stress within like the first 48 hours.
But it's called an acute stress disorder, as opposed to a post-traumatic stress disorder, where the same symptoms continue to appear, but they're appearing 30 days or longer after the incident.
And could this go on for years? And if not dealt with, or how does, what's the normality?
Well, the vast majority of people do quite well. Normally in critical incidents, between 4% and 10% of the general population faced with a life-threatening event of trauma can go on to experience a post-traumatic stress disorder. But the vast majority of people do quite well. Symptoms can go on, and they can last for years. But we see this in individuals who tend to not wish to address issues, who tend to try and push these disturbing thoughts out of their mind, as opposed to looking at them and looking at the meaning and the conclusions that they have drawn. Because frequently, they will draw a false conclusion, an inaccurate conclusion that allows them to continue to suffer unnecessarily, to live in the shadow, of the trauma of this movie theater. And that is unfortunate. And that's the very reason why, for example, the International Associations of Chiefs of Police and many local law enforcement organizations really aggressively try and assist those who serve in our communities to help them to overcome any residual effects of a horrible incident.
Now, obviously, they're the families of the people who were taken, the people who died. And one of the most interesting developments in Colorado was there's a suggestion that, for instance, that people should not mention the perpetrator's name or alleged perpetrator's name. Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper apparently decided to use the term Suspect A. And at least one of those, a brother of one of the victims, said, let us remember the names of the victims and not the name of the coward who committed this act. What about that? I guess that's sort of a natural reaction. But what about those people who weren't in a theater? They perhaps have lost somebody there. What's their trauma like?
Well, there's two points there. You know, one is that in this early phase following this traumatic event, that anger, which is a normal reaction to situations like this, but it can overwhelm and interfere with the grieving process. This is a time for grieving. Justice, which is a virtue across all cultures, will ultimately come, that we will move through in our system of law in the United States a process of where justice will occur. But that right now, this is a time for the family members and for the first responders who are dealing with this traumatic event to heal their wounds. In grieving, there is no timeline for grieving. It can take weeks or it can take years. Anyone that tells you that a normal time for grieving would be this amount of time or that amount of time really doesn't know what they're talking about. But that to encourage the individuals who have lost friends or loved ones to be thinking about those loved ones, what they have lost, to allow the grieving, to allow the emotions to come forth. When they do that, then they can continue to the process of moving on and healing, taking meaning from this loss, taking meaning of what we can take from this experience that makes us a better father, a better mother, a better brother, a better husband.
And just in a matter of 30 seconds or so, we seem to also be seeing this through very, very new technology with certainly all news cable, cell phone footage. How does that affect us as we look at it from the outside?
Well, certainly we should not allow our children, our small children or our preteens, to really be looking at this, because that can traumatize and create fear in our children. That it's a dose response. If you're just having a regular diet of looking at this, that can have a deleterious effect. We call it vicarious traumatization, that we are traumatized by seeing the experience through video. Again, if we are bothered by that, then we move towards the image and look at the thoughts that we are having, because it is thoughts, not events, that determine our emotional reactions.
We've been speaking with Michael Finnegan. He is Executive Director of the Peninsula Mental Health Services in Salisbury. His organization provides assistance to government and law enforcement organizations in Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. And in the first half of our program, we talked with Council President Terry Cohen, Council President, of course, of the Council here in Salisbury, Maryland, about the current controversy there. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.